The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, November 23rd, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. And it's no secret that President-elect Donald Trump does not think that the media has treated him fairly these past many months.
It's record-setting bad treatment, what I'm getting. It's the greatest pile-on in American history. I go to these rallies, and they're starting to hate the media because they see it's all a big lie. And not all, but a lot of it's a big lie.
Now, this isn't new, of course. Donald Trump and his campaign used the media, which is a phrase almost without definition, to focus anger of his crowds.
Now, there's a voter fraud also with the media, because they so poison the minds of people by writing false stories. They are the I believe, actually, they are more crooked than crooked Hillary. I really do. That's a lot.
Now, on the one hand, as president-elect, Donald Trump appears to be learning that to be president is to not like the press coverage you're getting sometimes. And much of the political press may be, for the first time in years, actually stretching its adversarial muscles. Every president has a partly symbiotic and partly dysfunctional relationship with the press. But Donald Trump so far is like no other president-elect. And the relationship may require coping skills the press hasn't used in a very long time. Bill Keller is the editor-in-chief of the Marshall Project and former executive editor of our partner, the New York Times. And he joins me now to discuss the president-elect's treatment of the press and the press's treatment of the president-elect since winning the election. Bill Keller, welcome.
Hi, Todd.
What's your take on this shifting landscape and how a responsible press in a democracy might want to cover somebody like Donald Trump?
Well, you know, Trump not only upset the norms of how candidates behave, he actually upset the norms of how the mainstream media behaves. I mean, it would have been hard to imagine back when I was executive editor of the New York Times that we would have just used the word lie to describe something a candidate said. Maybe we should have done it more often. And certainly in Trump's case, it was justified because he has a sort of a strange relationship with the truth. But, you know, I mean, the New York Times ran a story on the front page, a week of whoppers from Donald Trump, that was just a list of things that he'd said that were untrue over the course of 1 week. That's a sort of new phase in the level of scrutiny that candidates are being given. Again, I think that's justified, but I think there's a little recalibration going on now. You know, do you want to call the president a liar as a matter of routine on the front page of the New York Times, or do you back off a little bit and just point out that, you know, here's what the president said, here's what the facts show, but maybe restrain yourself when it comes to actually calling him a name?
Well, we had two very different interactions between Donald Trump and the media organizations in just the last 48 hours. Broadcast executives and anchors went to Trump Tower, where Trump criticized and complained about coverage. And on the record at the New York Times, where he answered questions for about an hour, made some news. What do you make of these two interactions and the relationship so far?
Well, the broadcasters are getting a lot of flack for having acceded to Trump's demand that it be completely off the record. I sort of sympathize with them. They've got jobs to do, and the jobs, particularly in broadcast, require some access. So, you know, they were in more in negotiating mode than news gathering mode. But I'm proud to see my old employer, the New York Times, take a more aggressive approach and basically call Trump's bluff and say, you know, we'll give you 15 minutes with the publisher off the record to talk about our relationship, but we want you to stick around and answer questions because that's what presidents and presidents-elect are supposed to do.
So where is this relationship headed, do you think? I have a sense that with the new administration coming in, and this happens all the time to an extent, but there are parts of this that are unique. The press and the president-elect kind of, if I dare say, sniffing around each other in a new way here.
You know, we've had presidents in my lifetime with tense relationships with the press, Richard Nixon famously, and George W. Bush comes to mind. But we've never had one quite like this, where they came off of a campaign where it was just seething with mutual hostility. I know a lot of people in the press since Election Day have been going through the sort of stages of grief or the equivalent of that. You know, the first being a kind of self-flagellation over how did we not see this coming, and, you know, a sense of, oh, my God, we're going to face the most press-hostile administration of our lifetimes. And, by the way, we told you what Donald Trump was and who he was, and voters ignored us. So there's a sort of existential angst. The media seems to have now moved into the stage of looking for silver linings. Oh, look, he's talking to Mitt Romney. He invited, he took an invitation from the New York Times and answered questions, and he's trying to make nice.
Right. Well, this debate is ongoing, and a lot of people in the press and reporters have been comfortable defending media norms when it comes to Donald Trump's treatment of them, and less comfortable defending political and cultural norms of the broader democracy. And there's going to be a lot to see as this president-elect transitions into the White House. Bill Keller, editor-in-chief of the Marshall Project and former executive editor of the New York Times. Thank you so much, Bill.
You're welcome.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
Remember that moment after Richard Nixon left office in disgrace? Infamous words in an interview with David Frost. Nixon there was referring to a crackdown plan against his domestic political opponents. But let's move on to the modern day now. Throughout the course of his campaign, President-elect Donald Trump has said that if he won, he would not blend his business and political interests, pledging to turn over management of his Trump Organization to his children. But again and again over the last 2 weeks, reports have emerged that Trump and his family continue to mix the presidential transition with business. Indian business partners met with the president-elect in the past week. They're in on some Trump condo buildings together. Trump's hotel in Washington is courting foreign diplomats to stay and spend there when they're in D.C. on official business. There's Trump's ongoing fight over wind farms that he doesn't want messing up the views near his golf courses in Scotland. The list goes on and on. On Tuesday, in his meeting with the New York Times, Trump was asked about his business interests in countries all over the world. And he said, "The law is totally on my side. The president can't have a conflict of interest." That sounds familiar.
Well, when the president does it, that means that it is not illegal.
Kenneth Gross is a partner at Skadden, Arps, Slate, Marr and Flom, an international law firm that advises corporations and elected officials on ethics law. Kenneth, welcome to The Takeaway.
Yeah, Todd.
That meeting with The New York Times yielded some news on Donald Trump and growing questions of his conflicts of interest. Now, that statement that he made, I think there are two parts that are critical. He says the law is on my side. And would you agree that most of the ethics regulations that apply to people in the federal government, except some clear prohibitions in the Constitution, say that indeed the law doesn't apply to the president when it comes to conflict of interest?
That's largely correct.
So the law is on his side, but then Trump goes on to say the president can't have a conflict of interest. And this is problematic because that doesn't mean if there's no law that stops you from doing it, it doesn't mean there's no conflict of interest. It just means that you can't be punished for it.
That was not a good way to put it. It sounds a lot like, because I'm the president, I can't do wrong. And, of course, we learned that's very much not the case. So he needs, obviously, not only to follow the letter of the law, which in a sense is sort of saying I'm not going to do anything because the law doesn't prescribe that he do anything regarding these domestic conflicts. He needs to take a very hard look at this situation. Running a business and asking your lawyer whether you can take a tax deduction or whether you can get a building built without a permit is a business situation. Running the government in Washington, D.C., and I've seen this over my career, is a very different skill set. And if you're going to go with the letter of the law on issues like ethics, it's not going to go well.
Doesn't he risk operating under constant suspicion? Every move in a foreign country is now subject to journalism or whatever about how his own personal interests may be affecting any deal he makes. That lowers his own political capital.
Absolutely. A very good point. And the criticism of him may well be unfair. He may be doing something perfectly in the interest of the American people, of foreign policy, taking a harsh position with a foreign government or perhaps an easy one. And they're going to say, oh, no, that's about that golf course or building he's trying to build in that country with a corporation that may be controlled or owned or somehow an arm of the government. And it's going to be a constant thorn in his side unless he takes definitive steps to deal with the separation of business and governing.
The emoluments clause of the Constitution specifically prevents a president from receiving any payments from a foreign government, king or prince. It says king or prince, interestingly. Does Donald Trump risk violating the emoluments clause?
Yes, the emoluments clause is a real thing. It's in the Constitution, but it is alive and well. It is interpreted by the Department of Justice regularly as it applies to presidents and other people in the administration, and it does apply to the president. He's got business dealings in foreign countries, some of them very unfriendly to the U.S., where these businesses are controlled or perhaps owned by foreign governments. Those are factual questions as to whether the clause applies, but it is something that he needs to deal with, and that's why I would draw the attention, if I were him, to his international holdings first.
And in short, Kenneth Gross, would you urge him to liquidate those holdings now?
That's a tougher issue, and I'm not ready to go there quite because it's much easier said than done. His holdings are largely illiquid. They're real estate, golf courses, but certainly internationally, I would look towards liquidation.
Complicated financial holdings of Donald Trump as he takes the presidency. Kenneth Gross, a partner at Skadden, Arp, Slate, Marr, and Flom, international law firm and ethics lawyers. Thank you so much, sir.
Sure.
So are you dreading the political discussion around the Thanksgiving table this year? We asked you for your go-to talking points to change the subject if things get dicey. We're using the hashtag So Anyway.
This is Eric from Jacksonville. If you want to avoid politics, just bring up Pokemon Go, evil clowns, greaseless turkey fryers, and if all else fails, just hold the dessert at ransom.
This is Chris calling from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My suggestion for avoiding political talk during Thanksgiving is to assign everybody a non-political book or show to watch and then discuss at the Thanksgiving table. And just as little added incentive, anybody caught in political discussion during the day will have to switch plates with the family dog.
This is Laura from Camas, Washington. I write several open-ended, thought-provoking questions on slips of paper. These are placed in a small pot which is passed around the table. We always end up with thoughtful answers and thoughtful conversation.
Chef Jim Gray tweeted us, "So anyway, would you like me to show you how a turducken is made?" And from Portland, Oregon, "So anyway, have you been to the theater lately? I hear the local Nutcracker is going to be stellar." So anyway, if you need to change the subject quickly, you know where to find us. We're on Twitter, at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by American Express. American Express has cards and services designed for businesses of all sizes. Learn more at open.com.
There was a hashtag that was trending right after the elections a couple of weeks ago. It was Booker 2020. But when you talk to New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker, he says that 2020 is the furthest thing from his mind right now. I spoke with Cory Booker about what led to the stunning defeat on Election Day for Democrats and how Booker perceives the administration that Donald Trump is assembling so far. Cory Booker told me that he's in crisis mode.
In this election, we won the popular vote, and it seems to be we're gaining more and more votes above and beyond what Donald Trump got every single day as votes are continuing to be counted. But there is definitely lessons to be learned and a lot more postmortem. And what I worry about is often the interests of those Americans that the Democratic Party has been known for years for representing, that somehow that focus was not represented in the way that it should. You know, I've got 99 colleagues. I go back to living in a census tract that's the poorest census tract of all the people in the Senate. I live in a census tract that where the median income is $14,000 a year. The majority of people are below the poverty line. Every single day, what sent me into politics was fighting to defend folks that live in that struggle. And I get very frustrated. I want my party to be front and center, to be focused on an America that works for every single person. And right now, people, and frankly, people in both parties just don't feel that. And I want my party to be the champion of that ideal.
So, Senator, you've voiced your concern over your colleague, Jeff Sessions, and his impending nomination as attorney general, given his record on civil rights, his record on race. Democrats don't have the ability to filibuster these nominees because you all got rid of the filibuster when it comes to nominees. Is this going to be a rhetorical fight for you?
Well, I think for me, it's going to be a fight to try to awaken the conscience of our country. We have a nation right now where there's actually a growing consensus on the brokenness of our criminal justice system, that we have a nation that is singular in humanity for incarcerating its own people for nonviolent offenses, many of which the last two presidents and many members of Congress have done themselves. And so the one person in the Senate who has been fighting hardest against criminal justice reform, that's been supported by Republican Chuck Grassley, supported by the Koch brothers, supported by Newt Gingrich, the one person who's been fighting against the kind of reforms that have helped states, those that have enacted them, lowering crime, lowering taxpayer expenses, and raising the ideals of justice, has been Jeff Sessions. And so this is unacceptable to me, but it should be an outrage to Republicans as well, that the very person that's fighting against the trends we're seeing around the country is now going to be the lead law enforcement officer who has said unequivocally what he intends to do should he get this kind of power when he was a senator.
Senator, how far do you want your leadership to go in opposing a potential early Supreme Court nominee?
Well, it's very important that Democrats don't become what they've criticized for the last 8 years under Obama. Remember, this was a moment where 8 years ago, where Republican leaders were standing up and saying, our number one goal is to not allow Obama to have a second term. That's despicable to me, and I will never do that. So my number one goal is to serve the American people. My number one goal is to protect the rights and privileges of all citizens. And when it comes to Supreme Court justices, I just went through the hell of having Republicans say, I don't care who he puts up. We're not going to even have a hearing on that. So I'm going to give a fair hearing and be open to any candidate he puts up before I design my tactics or declare that I'm going to stop somebody.
Important, likewise, for Democrats to try to get a couple of early wins cooperating with Donald Trump. There are signals from your leadership. Hey, we might get some agreement on infrastructure. We might get an agreement on trade deals if we agree there. Of course, other voices in your party want opposition. They're stung by the election. From inside the Senate, where do you come down on this?
You know, I get up every morning when I'm home in Newark, New Jersey. There are folks who are great Americans who work hard every day, who are struggling with real issues. That's my barometer for what I'm going to do. Now, I know one thing. I will not cooperate with hate or bigotry or anybody that's doing things to demean or degrade or undermine Americans. And so I have a critical eye towards the larger fight against the kind of toxicity, Twitter troll-like activities, the way that Donald Trump campaigned, the people he's pulling around him like Steve Bannon. This to me is a real threat to the character and culture of our country, and I intend to fight that with every ounce of my being. Everything that I have seen over the last year, from the way this man campaigned to the people he's now choosing to be in his inner circle and intends to have leading this country, alarms are going off. And I am talking to people around the clock now about how we best can resist should he try to divide our country and degrade people in this nation, and how we can begin to fight back for the principles and ideals and the highest aspirations of who we are as a people.
So before we let you go, this is a time of reassessment among Democrats, stinging loss. You know that your name is at the top of the five or six people that Democrats are saying they might want to put up in 2020. Are you considering positioning yourself to be a national leader for the next election cycle? How are you thinking about the next couple of years? I know you're focused on New Jersey. I get it. But people in your position also have to think about other possibilities in their careers.
Well, I'll resist anybody in my party that wants to start talking about and strategizing about 2020. I think that's what really turns off Americans about politics and politicians. In 4 years, people could lose their families, people could lose their health care, people could lose their security. The threats that are coming at us if Donald Trump intends to follow through on the kind of things he was saying during his campaign are real, and there are people that will be hurt by this, people that could lose their liberty as a result of this, people who could have their lives threatened. So I'm sorry, this is a crisis for me. This is not about politics. this is a time that we need to fight for our country and for our countrymen and women, because at the end of the day, this is a moment in American history where I think the character of our country will be defined, and all of us should see it as a call of our citizenship to be far more engaged than we ever have in doing the things that can unite us as a nation, and we can't let somebody tear that down.
A crisis for Senator Cory Booker as the 115th Congress is set to begin in January with a Democratic minority and a new presidency for President-elect Donald Trump. Senator Cory Booker, Democrat from New Jersey. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
Authorities in South Dakota have defended using water hoses against protesters on Sunday night in freezing weather at the Dakota Access Pipeline on the Standing Rock Reservation. You're hearing some of that now. At least 300 people were injured in the standoff, 26 of them seriously, as the fight over the construction of a $3.7 billion pipeline stretching from North Dakota to Illinois drags on. In a statement to the LA Times, the Morton County Sheriff's Department denied using concussion grenades on protesters at Standing Rock. Tara Hauska is National Campaigns Director for Honor the Earth. She's Ojibwe, and she's on the ground at Standing Rock in North Dakota.
As it stands right now, we've gotten reports back that one woman, Sophia Walensky, that was extremely hurt, 21-year-old girl that was hit by a concussion grenade by the police, she's going to lose roughly 80% of her arm function. The police are trying to say that she was creating an explosive, but unfortunately for them, there's shrapnel from their concussion grenade in her arm. So people got very, very, very hurt by the police, and this has been a continued escalation over the past few months to the point that they're now attempting to basically kill people. They sprayed hundreds of people in below freezing weather with water cannons to try and push them back from trying to clear a public road. There's a public road between the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and Bismarck Mandan. Those are the two major cities around the area that also are the hospital access. So for this woman that was really, really hurt and all these other people who were, I mean, there's over 100 people treated for hypothermia. They had to go miles and miles and miles around to get to the nearest hospital. And the police have now, actually, as of yesterday, they've built this huge concrete barricade. I mean, they did just block that road to the reservation. So they've cut off the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation from Bismarck.
How many people are out at the protest site now?
It's very, very full. This is as full as it was earlier this summer. So I'd say upwards of, you know, 5,000-6,000 people at least. Despite the efforts to demoralize us, you know, the Morton County, that's like the local processing place that's actually charged most of us with crimes. They actually, you know, have been putting people in dog kennels after being arrested. I was actually arrested a couple weeks ago, and that was the experience. And strip searched for misdemeanor charges. You know, this really demoralizing, demeaning experience, but people have remained resilient and more people are coming.
So what is your sense of the state of the protest now? Often these situations can sort of get into long brewing stalemates. You have thousands of people out at the encampment, as you said. There's a holiday weekend coming where a lot of Americans may, you know, disengage from the news in order to be with their families. That's sort of natural. How do you, from where you sit, assess the state of the protests and where they might be headed in the coming weeks?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's important to recognize that the folks here, we're not calling ourselves protesters, we're calling ourselves protectors. Protection in the sense of we're protecting the water and protecting sacred sites. So that narrative of protesting, we're not protesting something, we're trying to protect something from being destroyed. You know, and as far as the holiday weekend, you know, I think it's important to recognize that Thanksgiving is the holiday in which there's this rosy story of pilgrims and Indians sitting down together and having a meal, right? Like that's what school children all over America continue to learn, is this false narrative of this happy meal together, when in fact, you know, the reality is this genocide of Native American people. You know, this is an opportunity in which to say, as you're sitting down to your meal and you're spending time with your family and there's this kind of narrative of pilgrims and Indians, think about the real Native people that are fighting for their drinking water out in Standing Rock, that are fighting for their sacred sites, that are undergoing human rights violations today in 2016. That's happening. Their treaties are being violated in 2016. Our rights are being trampled and horribly, horribly disregarded. So, you know, and it happens to be the weekend, too, that the Cowboys are playing the Washington football team. you know, a racist slur that we've been fighting for almost 60 years. So it's a perfect opportunity in which to really learn about Native people and the struggles we're still facing.
So Tara Hauska, for people who don't know, what's the redress that you're seeking here? There is the Dakota Access Pipeline. It was going to go closer to a city. It's now gone closer to the reservation near the Missouri River. What is the redress that you all want to see? Simply a rerouting of the pipeline, its original route? What's this about?
So this pipeline was originally routed, as you said, rerouted from Bismarck, a 94% white community, due to concerns over the drinking water, risk to the drinking water, and it was rerouted to go half a mile north of the reservation. You know, that's environmental racism on its face. It's, okay, so our drinking water matters, but yours doesn't, in Dakota Access, the company's mind. So I think, one, you know, that's something that needs to be addressed and something that should not happen. There should not be sacrifice zones in any situation. You shouldn't be putting pipelines through, you know, low wealth, low income communities and just thinking that, hey, it's fine. You know, they don't matter. You know, Flint, Michigan doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if they have clean drinking water. It should never happen that way. I hope that, you know, ultimately that this project is, you know, it fails. It would send a message to the fossil fuel industry about pushing over indigenous rights. It would send a message to our Congress about having a relationship with big oil and the fact that, you know, our relationship with fossil fuels needs to change. And I think, you know, that larger narrative of indigenous people still being here and having rights and, you know, equality and things that should already be in place in this time, in this era.
The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe continues their protest, their protection, as they call it, against the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. Tara Hauska, National Campaigns Director for Honor the Earth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. South Carolina Republican Governor Nikki Haley is President-elect Donald Trump's pick to be his ambassador to the United Nations. She has no federal government or diplomatic experience, but she did negotiate overseas trade deals for her state as governor in South Carolina. Haley is Indian American. She's the first woman to get a high-level role in the Trump administration. Nancy Soderbergh is former U.S. ambassador to the U.N. under President Bill Clinton. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Your initial reaction to Nikki Haley for your old job?
I think it's a good choice. She is a very new, you know, face on the scene, so we don't really know. But her record as governor is one of embracing tolerance. She pushed back on Donald Trump's language, pushed back on white supremacy, and actually lowered the Confederate flag in a very conservative state. So I think it's a good choice.
Does a lack of experience on the foreign stage with diplomacy or in the foreign service or with any, you know, diplomatic negotiations, does that really matter in this job?
Well, it's certainly an easier job if you've had a lot of experience. But frankly, any governor has had foreign policy experience, and that type of executive experience, I think, prepares one well for this job. She's new, so she'll certainly have a very steep learning curve. But I'm confident that her instincts will be one of engaging the rest of the world. I think the bigger question is what types of policies she's going to have to implement. And if the early indications of Donald Trump's selection so far are of ideologues who will push an unrealistic agenda, much like George Bush, George W. First 9 months before 9/11, they were trying to kill the ICC, trying to basically ramrod America's ideological views around the world, and particularly at the UN. It didn't work. That all changed after 9/11. So if Trump starts his presidency off with trying to undercut America's position in some of the key UN deals, like the climate change, like the Iran deal, International Criminal Court, Law of the Sea, those types of issues, then she's going to have a very tough job.
Does that potentially put someone like Nikki Haley, then, if she's ambassador at the UN, kind of on point in a difficult way. If she's got a boss and an administration, we don't know yet, but shows contempt either for the UN mission or for various agreements, or wants to charge around like a bull, as you said, and she is in the UN dealing with other diplomats, dealing with the institution, and dealing with the agreements that are already on the table, she's potentially got a difficult job ahead of her.
Absolutely. If President Trump in January or else, you know, signals these things before, that he's going to pull out of the climate change, pull out of the Iran deal, undercut the various conventions that we've been working with, like the Law of the Sea, various human rights agreements that are out there, she's going to have an impossible job. There is hope, I think, that he's going to move away from some of those positions. For instance, he's all of a sudden discovered that humans have something to do with global climate change. He said that the other day. Wow, okay, maybe that's true. So he does seem open. I mean, the fact that he has to learn from this low level and he's almost president is frightening to many of us who work in this field, but I think we all want him to succeed. And if he shifts away from those positions, she will be one of the most influential members in his administration.
President-elect Donald Trump set to name South Carolina Republican Governor Nikki Haley as ambassador to the United Nations. She'll have to be confirmed by the Senate. Nancy Soderberg, former U.S. ambassador to the U.N., thank you so much.
My pleasure.
When it comes to terrorism, most of the world has been focused on ISIS in Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere. But Nigeria-based militant group Boko Haram proved to be more deadly than any other terrorist organization last year. Many of its victims are women and girls who are held captive by the group or brought in through radicalization and marriage. But one woman is working to undo some of that damage. Fatima Askira is the executive director of the Borno Women's Development Initiative, where she's focused on working with local government officials and other humanitarian groups in Nigeria to reintegrate women who've lived under Boko Haram rule. I spoke with her from Maiduguri, Nigeria, and she says sometimes the hardest part is convincing Nigerian civilians that it's safe for these women to return to the societies that they were once part of.
Most of those women we find in Boko Haram were married to the Boko Haram fighters even before the violence escalated. And then when the violence escalated and they had to leave within the city and run outskirts, some of them had to carry their women. Some willingly followed them, while some were forced to abduct them. But 60 to 70% of them are victims, and it's a choice between living and dying. And even for the few of them that are maybe radicalized, they could be de-radicalized, and then, trust me, they can fit in perfectly back into the communities and societies.
How did you first come to realize that women leaving Boko Haram needed help, and what made you want to help them?
Women are, like, most affected. Of course, men were equally affected, but then a woman would have to deal with a lot of consequences. So I felt there's just need to help those women to get back into the society. Because the more we leave them vulnerable, the more we leave them empty, then the more terrorists we are breeding, since they have children and those children are very young. And it's just so much to face, I feel.
Well, when they want to come out of Boko Haram and reintegrate into the village or the town that they're from, what do you find that they need most? What are their most pressing needs?
The pressing need for them, you know, at the initial was, how could we even come back to the society? Because the stigma actually exists. The community is not even ready to accept some of those women. So I feel the immediate need for them is to have a safe space where they can actually pull themselves back together and then have food and then have something to cover their body. Then we could pick up from there by giving them some psychosocial support and taking them through the process.
Does Nigeria have a rehabilitation infrastructure for someone like this? Are there, I assume that there isn't a lot of deep access to psychologists or institutions that help with this kind of thing. It must be difficult.
Yeah, actually, it's very difficult. I think in Nigeria, we have such structures, but even as we have them, I don't think they are as functional as they should be. Because basically, some of those women are lost and kind of need such support. But unfortunately, they don't have access to such facilities or information that could lead to those facilities. But then with coming of the insurgency and then the trooping of the international aid workers and the local aid workers understanding that this is what people need psychosocial support, then a lot of programming has been designed through that, but I don't think we have any bigger infrastructure that captures that.
And those women themselves, when they've had a little bit of experience, maybe back in the village or back in the town, what did they tell you about their own experiences trying to regain acceptance?
Their experience based on living with those fighters is like most of them are just wives and they do not have an idea of the extent to which these fighters are violent and the effects of violence on the community. So one way or the other, I get to understand that there is a total disconnect between these women and what is happening in the reality.
Fatima Askira, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Fatima Askira is Executive Director of the Borno Women Development Initiative. Fatima Askira's story came to us from News Deeply's Women and Girls Hub. They report on issues affecting women and girls in the developing world. To find out more, you can visit newsdeeply.com/womenandgirls. Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. And as we head into the long weekend when, let's face it, a lot of us are going to eat more food than we should, almost 10 million children between the ages of 10 and 17 in this country are food insecure. It means they don't have reliable access to enough nutritious food. Teenagers handle hunger differently than adults and younger children. The embarrassment and stigma of being poor can keep them away from food pantries, and free meals at school can seem unappetizing, repetitive, and, in fact, embarrassing. In extreme cases, hunger drives young people to steal or even engage in prostitution with older men for a meal. That's according to a report from the Urban Institute entitled Impossible Choices. But a group of teenagers from the New Columbia neighborhood in Portland, Oregon, wants to change that through their work with Home Forward. It's a service and housing organization in Oregon. These kids have seen hunger in their communities and sometimes in their own families, but they're now bringing free fresh produce and other food to their neighborhood and others in need through a program called Harvest Share. We talked with two of those teens about their experiences and their volunteer work, 16-year-old Roman Dominguez and 17-year-old Faiza Jama.
In the New Columbia area, we have a store called the Village Market where students, you know, or kids in the neighborhood go to. And I seen some students steal from that store. And sometimes it's because they don't have food at home for them to eat and they don't have money on them. So their only option is to steal food from there. Or like some people talked about, you know, hooking up with older men just so they can have their needs met, or like selling drugs because that's the only way they believe they can find access to things that they need. And at school, like some of the students, they don't really like having the same food every single day, like the nachos and burritos. And sometimes that can get like really annoying and nasty after a while. So they just go to nearby stores like Fred Meyer's and go steal from there. So that's kind of what I've been seeing around like my school and my community.
Faiza, I want to circle back to something because you said something that really stood out. You said you know kids who've hooked up with older men, mm-hmm. I assume, to get money to be able to buy food.
Mm-hmm. And there'd be like older people who have been kind of in sex trafficking and stuff like that. And they would come to our school and talk about how they got involved in that kind of work. And it's not something that they do with like because they want to, but it's just because of their options or... I mean, it's not a choice that we all want to make, but it's just something because of the situations that we're in, we end up being at. And I can't blame them for being in those situations.
Roman, I'd like to ask you about some of your own personal experiences with hunger, maybe some of the times that you've been hungry and what you had to do about it.
Personally, my family, thank God, has never had to go through that phase of us being worried about not having a meal on the table like the next day. My parents have always said, if we don't have money for the rent, but we're always going to have money for food. But to the people who do go through that, it's sad because we're in a country where we have so much money, but why don't we have kids or any families not having food? But at our school, we have the privilege to have free lunch for everybody, despite, and anybody gets free lunch. So I don't feel like just because you get school food at our school, no one's going to judge you or criticize you because we all get offered free lunch.
So, Faiza, let me ask you about all these programs and being able to participate in it. How has it made you feel? And do you think you're starting to have a impact in your community?
For sure. I mean, growing up in Somalia, I didn't really have access to food, and hunger was always like a big issue within the community that I lived in back home. And being able to come here to the United States, I really thought like I would no longer be in those situations again. But after being in New Columbia for a very long time and realizing that food insecurities and like issues around hunger still exist, made me realize that this is an international problem and that we as youth really need to step up and take charge. We know that we have to be the future leaders of tomorrow. And that's when we started really leading and creating programs and really making changes. We have this harvest share every third Saturday of the month, and the youth that are volunteer get to shop first. And the reason why I do that is because when youth see that other youths are getting food from the food pantries and the harvest shares, and we just empower each other and make it seem like this is not something we should be embarrassed about, and it's okay. If we need food and the community has this program, then let this help us like get our foods and like let's lessen hunger. And
Roman, you wanted to say something.
I just want to say to all the youth out there, like, just because you see that you're going through tough times doesn't mean that can stop you from letting your voice be heard. Like, just know that despite anything, your voice can be heard. You can make a change. Just how we made a change, you can make it as well for your community. Like, just because you always see adults in power, that's not true. Because youth have the same abilities as an adult to lead and make a change for their communities. Just go out there and find a group of people, of youth, and just think of programs that can help your community just like we did, and then you can make change just like us.
And, you know, Faiza, it's really amazing one thing you said. You came all the way from Somalia,
mm-hmm.
But a lot of Americans probably don't know or don't want to know that hunger and food security is a problem right here in their mm-hmm. own country.
There was one thing that really, like, stuck out to me that I wanted to share with everybody that's listening and that's everybody that's here, and is that there was this one lady that came in with, like, a really, she was, like, crying, and it was tears of happiness, and she came up to me and said that, thank you for doing this, and thanks, like, she thanked all the youth that were there and really speaking up and, like, being the change of their community, and she told me that because of you guys, my family can eat this week, and that really, like, stuck out to me, and, like, still till this day, it's something that I always keep in the back of my head, and, like, it's like, my confirmation that I'm being the change that I have always wanted to see in the world, and, like, it's, like, a privilege in a way, and, you know, those were the words that my mom would say back home in Somalia when she would be able to find food for us, and, you know, it just took me back for a moment that I was once in those situations, and here I am today making change and helping people get out of those situations that I was in once. And that's like a really powerful thing.
That's Roman Dominguez, who's 16, and Faiza Jama, who's 17. They're working to fight hunger in their community in Portland, Oregon. Well, there's going to be political talk around the table at Thanksgiving. We know that, and that's great. But there are times when you're just going to need to change the subject, and we've been asking you for your quick subject changers with the hashtag SoAnyway from Santa Rosa, California. So anyway, I'm pregnant.
This is Andy from Isatawket, New York. I'm going to bring up all the old personal failings of my siblings and cousins, and then I'm going to keep my mouth full of food.
This is Anna Sebrian from Los Gatos, California. Two easy conversation topics are, what movies have you seen lately? Or which version of Shameless do you prefer, the American or the British one?
Hi, my name's PJ. I'm calling from Montauk, New York. Maybe talk about the weather. Now, just bear with me. I'm serious here. There's a brand new weather satellite that's supposed to change everything in weather prediction, including real-time pictures of what's going on. It's really awesome.
Stephanie Wilson treats us. So anyway, cannabis is legal for adults to use in 8 states now. And Elena says, so anyway, have you ever cheated on grandma?
Hi, this is Heather Ulrich calling from Eugene, Oregon. So anyway, who's your favorite contestant on The Voice?
This is Kathy from St. Petersburg, Florida. Here in the South, just mentioned football, and you are good to go for hours.
This is Wes from Ogden, Utah, and I just got a puppy, so I am set through Christmas.
And of course, some of you know tough conversations are necessary and you don't want to change the subject.
Claudia from Chicago, Illinois. So anyway, I will be talking about politics this Thanksgiving because we can't just pretend this is going to go away. We need to have the difficult conversations and bring people in to actually make change.
But keep tweeting at The Takeaway with your conversation changers. So anyway, thanks for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.